So much of this is based on the notion, right? The opportunity agenda of the 1960s looms large here, that largely our political economy is sound and that we just need to get people onto the ladder into it, right? That has been the underlying philosophy, gone by different names, gone by different sort of versions since then. I think nonprofits are wrapped up in the theory of the world that the political economy is basically sound, and we just need to get people into it, rather than saying maybe it's a problem with our political economy and the racial capitalism that undergirds it.
Welcome to the Death Panel. Patrons, thank you so much for supporting the show. We couldn't do any of this without you. And if you'd like to help us out a little bit more, share the show with your friends, post about your favorite episodes, pick up a copy of Health Communism, or pre-order Jules's new book coming January called A Short History of Transmisogyny at your local bookstore, or request them at your local library, and follow us at deathpanel_. So today I'm here with my co-hosts, Phil Rocco.
Hey.
And Jules Gill Peterson.
Hi.
And we are joined by a wonderful guest that we're very excited to talk to today about their book. Claire Dunning is a historian of the United States in the 20th century whose work focuses on poverty, racial capitalism, governance, and the nonprofit industrial complex, and is assistant professor of public policy and history at the University of Maryland College Park. Claire is the author of the book Nonprofit Neighborhoods, An Urban History of Inequality in the American State, published by University of Chicago Press. Claire, welcome to the Death Panel. It is so great to have you here today.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
First off, I mean, I know we were talking about this before we started, but we all really loved your book, and I really appreciated specifically the way that you think about your work as a historian, as using historical analysis to get at and attempt to offer an answer not to a question necessarily about the past, but a forward-looking question, as you've put it. And this book really does that in terms of trying to answer a few really important questions about why nonprofits have the role that they have in our political economy, and whether nonprofits, charity, or philanthropy can really truly achieve racial and economic justice, or if those goals are themselves prevented by the very structure of the state's relationship to these kinds of nonprofit organizations. But it also gets at this question sort of about why the state is the way it is and how it's constructed, and sort of how these choices and values that we sort of see and maybe take for granted as embedded in the political economy really have a very deep and important historical logic to them. And it's a really sort of careful and diligent history that was also fascinating and really fun to read. And I don't want to jump ahead, though. So just to start us off, for listeners who might not be familiar with the book or your work, can you talk about sort of some of the main arguments in Nonprofit Neighborhoods and elaborate on this idea that I mentioned, sort of about how you think of your work and how you think about history in terms of pointing us towards knowledge about the present?
Ooh, thank you for all of that. I think I'll start with your second question first. As a reader, I love to know where people come up with their research topics, and we dedicate so much of our lives to these things. I want to know sort of what's the human story behind it. So maybe I'll start offering my own and sort of why I think this history can and hopefully is useful to those of us in the present. After college, I was working at a community foundation for a couple of years, and it was my first exposure really to thinking about the nonprofit sector as a sector. So we were a grant-making entity. I was a sort of junior staff member who got to observe these larger conversations as my colleagues were grappling with both really sort of nitty-gritty questions about budgets and accountability and how our grant dollars were supporting particular programs, how they were evaluating their programs, et cetera. But then also grappling with big questions about legacies of racism. It was also the financial crisis. So we were sort of asking questions at the time about families going through foreclosure, but also nonprofits in the housing space going through foreclosure. And how did we and how could a foundation support these entities? And my colleagues were understandably thinking about the present and the future. And I just fundamentally couldn't understand why this was the set of relationships and what the role of the foundation was and what the role of the city government, who was often in a lot of these meetings, what their role could or should be in this moment of crisis. And to me, that was a historical question about how we got to this current landscape and why we had both such a rich array of nonprofit organizations and such persistent inequality. And there was some temporal mismatch, right? We were talking in 3 or 5 year grant cycles at best, and we're also talking about problems that are decades, centuries in the building. And we're talking about individual small neighborhoods, but also talking about a financial crisis that was enveloping the whole city, country, globe. So there were all these sort of puzzles that came up for me in that work. And again, plenty of people were asking about it in the present. And to me, it felt like a story whose origins lay in the past. So I went to graduate school, decided to write about the history of the nonprofit sector. Several of my advisors sort of had this puzzled look on their face when I said, I want to write about the nonprofit sector. And they said, well, what is that? And I said, well, A, I don't really know. And B, it's sort of an awkward term, right? Because the nonprofit mm-hmm. sector incorporates everything from really small organizations to huge universities and hospitals. So it's an awkward catch-all term. But I think that there's work that we can do to historicize it and understand why these entities are so ubiquitous in our contemporary landscape, particularly in cities, and why we rely on them in moments of crisis and moments of semi-stability to solve public problems, right? Why do we rely on private entities to solve public problems?
Right.
Why do we rely on small entities to solve big ones?
Mm-hmm.
And why do we rely on strategies that haven't really proven useful thus far? So those are sort of the questions animating this. And so it's a story about Boston, which I write about as both sort of on the vanguard of social welfare experimentation during the 20th century, as people sort of looked to the city and some of its successes and some of its failures as a model to replicate. It was a forerunner in a lot of federal programs. And it's a local story, because I think local stories give us that granularity to understand these big concepts of state and market and nonprofit sector, what that actually looks like. So the book, in brief, sort of locates the origins of what some people call the nonprofit industrial complex, or just sort of the growth of the nonprofit sector in the post-World War II period, in a moment where cities were undergoing significant demographic and political economic changes through deindustrialization and suburbanization. And cities seemed to be in this moment of urban crisis. And scholars have written a lot about this notion of urban crisis and how it was a constructed idea and social and political and economic manifestations. And I sort of write about, well, there's also a governance change, an administrative and how government functions comes out of this moment of crisis, comes out of urban renewal, where the government, for the first time, begins to make direct grants from the federal government to local community organizations, and grants that sort of employ and charge these local community groups to facilitate participation in urban renewal, provide some services to people who are being displaced by urban renewal. And what begins as a sort of this experiment on the ground, I write about a group called Freedom House in Boston, ends up becoming a blueprint for a wider array of policy and political strategies for dealing with civil rights protest, Black activism, longstanding structural poverty, and these patterns of grant making. Initially federal government to local, nonprofit, later mediated by different tiers of government, becomes a really popular way of managing crisis and responding to demands. And that popularity, while genuine for a lot of reasons, I argue really masks a deep inadequacy as a strategy for dealing with structural problems whose structural origins remain fundamentally intact. That small nonprofit programs, while valuable, while important, right? This isn't to denigrate the work that they do or the important, many ways life-saving role that nonprofit organizations can play. It's masking a sort of deeper undercurrent of inadequacy, and this has not been a strategy to repair historical and ongoing harms. And so that's sort of the overarch of the book. It goes from the 1950s to the present, traces the sort of rise of what we would call today social innovation, the notion that private entities can and should respond to our public problems, and argues that we need to think at a bigger structural level, not just did this organization build 10 units of housing or provide these after-school programs or tweak their budgets here or there, but let's try and have a bigger conversation about why these organizations play the roles that they do.
Well, I think, you know, B made a very good point here, which I think is that this book really helped me get some clarity on some pretty enduring. I mean, you're telling a story about one city, but as mm-hmm. somebody who's pretty familiar with politics in another city, right, or the city that I currently live in, there's so many resonances, not just because I think one line that recurs in your book is that, you know, Boston became a city of contrasts, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems mm-hmm. like every major American city, and certainly ones that experience this period of like deindustrialization, you know, now can be said to be a city of contrast, right? You're very wealthy, you know, extremely wealthy downtown and, you know, some neighborhoods, and then many neighborhoods that just feel completely abandoned by the city, where there's, you know, entrenched levels of poverty. And I think the related to that is the sense that where power lies is actually quite difficult to figure out, right? That like it would be impossible to say that if you want to understand where power lies in a city, that you should go to City Hall, right? that is often, you know, really not the case. And I think, you know, like moving to a new city, I'm always like, okay, trying to understand politics. And it evidently is really difficult, not just because journalism has been sort of like hollowed out, which it has been, but also because the journalism that does exist, it's really hard to report on things that go on behind closed doors with no public meetings of a very decentralized set of nonprofits, right? And I think that trying to understand sort of why that is, and why, you know, if you look at like the local government's tax rolls in whatever city you're in, you're going to see tons of exemptions, and the list of exemptions that tells you where, you know, power lies, really. But, you know, I think you historicize that as something that didn't, you know, emerge, you know, directly because of machinations at the local level, but really is the product of federal government strategies to try to respond to various iterations of what people called, with various meanings, like the urban crisis. And so I wonder if you could talk about, like, you know, this is really a story about the role of the state in reshaping the role of like the quote unquote, like voluntary sector to do things the state might otherwise be doing, and where power might otherwise be concentrated in government agencies. The state is actually doing things to change kind of where power lies. So I wonder if you could talk about like, what's the role of the federal government in changing the political landscape of cities?
Thank you for all of that. I think that was one of my biggest surprises. And I think I continue to surprise people by thinking about, we have this myth in the United States, right, of the independent nonprofit sector, the charitable realm. We call it the third sector, as if it is completely independent from state and market, right? And that's no accident that people are invoking and coming up with this term, right? Government money supports nonprofit organizations more than private donations. That fact, I teach it to my students, I write about it and talk about it with regard to my book. It's a shocking fact. We are so invested in this notion, pro or con, right, that the nonprofit sector is its own thing. But it is constituted by law, right, by political and policy underpinnings. The IRS regulates who is or who is not a nonprofit organization. And the notion that nonprofits are independent, right, the historical record shows us, no, not at all, right? Federal policies are creating government programs that are funneling dollars from government pockets into nonprofit organizations. And with dollars, right, if you've ever had a grant or applied for one, you know that that grant relationship is one of power and authority, but also of data sharing, of information, of budgets and control, right? So when the policy is coming down or coming out of Washington saying, all of you community organizations, please apply for funding. It's a level of surveillance and insight that the government gets to local organizations, and the government gets to set priorities around who the recipients are and sort of what cities, what the kinds of programs they're running. Some of the strings attached to these set by government policy include things like representation on boards of directors, who gets hired in what kinds of staff roles. And these administrative strings, they can cut in both directions, right? So in the 1960s, under the War on Poverty, the phrase maximum feasible participation, which under law constituted a requirement that recipient organizations had to employ and hold on their board of directors people whose lives were directly impacted by the programs that were being funded, right? So primarily this means people who are low income and people of color. And this requirement is a huge shift in terms of who's getting to make decisions. And people on the ground had to fight dramatically for representation on boards. Sometimes these rules increased, and a few occasions they decreased the role that local folks had over and organizations in their own neighborhoods. But all of this is structured by the state, by policy. What's happening in Boston is a hyper-local story. But Phil, as you said, right, it's happening all across the country because organizations like the ones I write about in Boston are being held to the same standards, are operating under the same sets of guidelines, right? The same kinds of programs and expectations, feedback mechanisms, budgetary requirements, reporting expectations, all of the reams of paperwork that are flowing between nonprofits and their funders, government funders, right, largely that I'm talking about. That's a level of sort of standardization that is enveloping the nonprofit sector at a particular moment of its growth, right? And so in many ways, the policies that are coming out in the 1960s and then continue to expand in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, et cetera, are a standardizing precedent that is actually encouraging the growth of the nonprofit sector. This is a moment when new organizations are being founded to take advantage of government programs that are offering to foot the bill. And that's a significant, sort of in many ways, radical opportunity that here is a chance for government dollars to reach communities that have traditionally been excluded from it. And on the one hand, that's a deeply radical moment, but it's also one that quite purposefully hides the presence of government in these private organizations. It's a way of circumventing white supremacist tiers of government by getting around exclusionary political systems, but it's also a way of masking government by sort of emphasizing the notion that private is better, private is more responsive in ways that it absolves the government of responsibility, even as they're really present in it. And it's that sort of complex landscape, I think, of where public and private are intersecting in ways that are both democratic and anti-democratic, and the presence of the state with these private organizations. It's messy and complicated. And to me, that's what makes this work fascinating and important to sort of tease out those various lines of there's no immediate good guys and bad guys, if we will, right? It's sort of these complex processes responding to an unequal landscape. But the state is so deeply present here. And nonprofit organizations are both simultaneously expanding state capacity, right? The ability for local groups to implement programs of their own design on public dollars is an absolute game changer, particularly in marginalized communities. And these relationships, right, they are appended to the state and they lose a lot of control when they accept these kinds of grant dollars. So it sort of cuts both ways. Mm.
And I wonder, you know, maybe before we move towards sort of more of the local story, because it's so fascinating, I just wanted to dig in a little on maybe, you know, two aspects of what you were just saying and be careful to avoid, I'm trying to be careful to avoid personifying the state too much, but I guess, you know, just wondering if you can tell us even more sort of like, why is the state interested in behaving this way, right? We're talking about principally, you know, the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and then into the Nixon administration a little bit as well. But this is the 60s. This is this, you know, in the mythology of American liberalism, this kind of high tide moment, particularly, you know, in Johnson's War on Poverty, you know, and this is sort of memorialized and perhaps mythologized by multiple political traditions as a kind of moment of maximum kind of public investment. And, you know, of course, the amount of money the federal government is sort of pumping, you know, through grants is certainly going up. But, you know, some of the things I think that the 60s are best are most remembered for are more direct public programs, like, say, Medicare. But here, you know, your book is really about a very key instrument that is rather different, right? Where the public is actually being privatized through partnership. And I wonder if you could just, like, give us a little, even a little more sense of sort of what's in it for the Johnson administration or the Kennedy administration. Why does the state prefer to operate in this manner? Why does it want to devolve, you know, power in theory towards the neighborhood level? You already made some allusions to some of the kinds of maybe motivations or strategies that are sort of concealed in there. You know, what is this sort of urban crisis, so to speak, that is on everyone's minds? And why are cities sort of poised to receive this money through the kind of nonprofit sector? Just sort of trying to really tease out kind of maybe the all the sort of state motivations here. But, like, yeah, why do it this way? Other than, you know, of course, this is America and things get done in this kind of way all the time. But specifically, right, this moment is so pivotal. And I just feel like really dialing in helps us see everything that has come since, really kind of emanating from this particularly charged moment in the 1960s.
Thank you for that. I think I also often fall prey to talking about the state in sort of non-personified forms. And it is people, right? One of the things I found so powerful about studying history is that these things aren't naturalized, and we can know people who made decisions and sort of locate who they were and what their motivations were. And if people made these choices, I find that empowering, because we as people can make other choices. So I really appreciate that nudge. And I'll tell a couple stories, actually, to sort of think through why this particular set of public-private partnerships is emerging. And some of it sort of slightly predates Johnson and Kennedy under urban renewal, where it's sort of at the end of the 1950s, urban renewal had this reputation, well-earned, of being top-down, and what James Baldwin called Negro removal, right? That the displacement of Black families and Black businesses, people were protesting that and sort of calling out the hypocrisy of these programs about who cities are being improved for and at whose expense. And so the sort of political crisis of urban renewal and the protests around it and demands for inclusion and a voice, the Federal Home and Housing Finance Agency writes a few rules into their guidelines saying, you know, use community groups, try partnering with them. And they're very vague about who constitutes a community group. And often it's sort of elite civic booster groups. But in Boston, in 1960, a new mayor had been elected, John Collins, and he had promised to do urban renewal differently. He promised to, quote, plan with the people and sort of separate this image of the top-down bulldozer to a slightly more participatory version of what this could look like. And so he hires a new renewal administrator, this man, Ed Logue, who comes from New Haven. And Ed Logue, to his credit, is sort of thinking in more capacious ways about not only the economic and physical renewal of the city, but what he calls social or human renewal might look like. How can we improve not just housing, but the lives of people in it? He has his own vision of what that could or might be. But he sort of has this openness about nonprofit organizations might be a part of that story. And at the same time that Ed Logue is sort of open to this, and he's talking to some folks at the Ford Foundation, a local community group led by Otto and Muriel Snowden, Freedom House, they're a Black couple of social workers in the neighborhood of Roxbury, they see urban renewal as actually a really good thing to come to their Black neighborhood, right? This is sort of a moment of indecision. And they say, we want those federal dollars, but we also want a role in sort of shaping them. And so they write a telegram to Ed Logue and say, if you don't include us in some of these conversations when you come to our neighborhood of Washington Park and Roxbury, it has to be understood as a moment of discrimination and we won't believe any other story. So Ed Logue says, okay, you know, let's give this a go. And they end up entering into a partnership with a contract, a grant that sort of cements this partnership, where Freedom House is going to take charge of facilitating community participation, which is a requirement for urban renewal, that there has to be some community input. And Freedom House says, we'll take charge of that process. So they sort of use federal dollars funneled through the Boston Redevelopment Authority to hire some local planners and organizers. They transform Freedom House. They hang all these maps on the wall. And it's this visual, I think, embodiment of this private space taking on a public role. They host community meetings and they really facilitate and get neighbors on board, and they liaise with the Redevelopment Authority. And in the end, they help facilitate a community vote where the residents of Washington Park get together and say, we approve this plan that Ed Logue and his team have listened to us and we're good to go. And it's a really profound moment because this has gone better in the Black neighborhood of Roxbury than it has in some parallel processes we're playing out elsewhere in some white neighborhoods in the city. And Ed Logue and the mayor are just thrilled, right? They have had the success story of they've listened a little bit. And, you know, right, let's be clear that this isn't a purely representational sort of process. It definitely skews towards middle class interests, and those of homeowners and working class Black folks are sort of squeezed out. But it, on the surface, is appears this beautiful moment of aha. Partnering with Freedom House helped the government get what it wants, and it helps appease protest and anger at being excluded in the Black neighborhood, right? So the racial politics of this, the local manifestations between, you know, local Freedom House and local Ed Logue as the renewal authority. And it becomes this sort of, in many ways, national story. Freedom House hosts the Society of American Planners. They tour groups from international audiences. It is this perfect, beautifully multiracial, liberal moment in the early 1960s. That Johnson hears about and others, and they say, aha, this is a way of both appeasing protest, moving forward this liberal agenda of urban renewal and sort of anti-poverty planning. And it's a way of sort of both absolving the government of responsibility, saying, here, you local nonprofit, you were so good at this, take charge of this bit, while also maintaining a degree of control, right? A grant can be given, but it can also be extracted. And so this balance of turning over degrees of autonomy and authority is a really powerful story in Boston. The mayor sort of gets on board. And of course, the mayor wants more and more control as more and more dollars come in. They sort of want to claw back some of that authority. But it's politically popular. And so at the federal level, when Johnson is trying to pass his war on poverty agenda and the Economic Opportunity Act, in the Johnson archives, I found this list of talking points when they were trying to sell it in Congress. And the talking points are trying to frame this new program, which is significant federal spending, right, is in coded and uncoded ways responding to Black poverty. So in that way, very clear with the liberal agenda. But their talking points are trying to remind their Republican and conservative colleagues, this is the oldest tradition in America of relying on these independent nonprofit organizations. They have degrees of autonomy. We are not responsible. We're not growing the size of government. So it can sort of be spun politically in a couple of different ways in two different audiences. And it's one of the things that I find so fascinating about the American political system and the sort of myth of the nonprofit sector is it is often something that liberals and conservatives can agree upon, right? We have this rarely those moments of convergence, but everyone loves a nonprofit. Everyone loves a nonprofit for different reasons and with sort of different versions of what that looks like. But when I teach this to my students, I just have this sort of laundry list of both Republicans and Democrats sort of relying on and sort of tapping into this myth of the independence. And so Johnson is very much doing that in the 1960s to respond to Black uprising and protest and rebellion, and to respond to need and growing poverty, and respond to sort of calls for self-determination. This is a way to do that in part. And that in part is really critical from both a policy and a political perspective.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that like you can see the not only the ideational kind of reason why this idea, you know, takes hold, but also sort of like sort of practical reasons why. I mean, like, I think it is in both, but in different ways, in both sort of conservative and progressive ideologies going back 100 years, you know, a central part of the mythos is like that you can do politics without power. Mm-hmm. That like you can somehow get rid of power. And so how are we going to get rid of power for conservatives? It's like we're going to get rid of like power, by which we mean like arbitrary rule, by turning things over to the markets where price signals will, you know, make sure that things don't happen arbitrarily. And for progressives, it's like we're going to get rid of power by channeling resources out of City Hall. Right. And towards neighborhoods, towards alternative sites of power. Now, in one sense, that's part of like the old and, you know, away from like monopolistic political parties. That's a big part of it, especially for progressives. Right. Is that the party is a parties are a problem, too, which is why you have so many nonpartisan elections. Right. At the local level after reform. But the you know, I guess there's one aspect of it, too, which is, I think, responds to a kind of concrete material reality, is that, you know, for in cities with, you know, political monopolies of any kind, black and brown residents are shut out of those. They're not politically incorporated. Right. Thinking of the first black alderwoman in Milwaukee, you know, was a member of the Democratic Party. They wouldn't even put ward healers in her ward. Right. There's like no political capacity like for her ward. So, I mean, to one extent, it's like this. There is actually a concrete material political reason for wanting alternative sites of power, because City Hall is like blocked off, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. No, I think that that's enormously important when we're thinking about the political landscape, right? That the traditional partisan democratic processes are deeply anti-democratic. And so black and brown and other excluded folks are running candidates and are not winning, right? So this is an alternate way of building up power outside of a exclusionary system. And that's appealing to a lot of people, building up this alternate site where people who don't have any ability to control or deliver services are getting to do so, are getting to design school curricula, after school programs, or housing, right? That the group in Boston I write about in the South End, called the Emergency Tenants Coalition, who build this, who protest and wrest control of an urban renewal project called Parcel 19 into a nonprofit-driven community development, and they rename the group the community Villa Victoria. Right, it's a Puerto Rican community, and they rename it Villa Victoria. They design it with a Puerto Rican architectural aesthetic. And you don't get that kind of control when you're running a purely government program. And so the sort of alternate source of power is really important, as you said, Phil. I think that's absolutely spot on. And I'll add separately something I did forget to mention about another reason this is so incredibly attractive is that foundations, right? We have to also think about the government money that's flowing into these realms. So the ability for a nonprofit to take both government and private dollars builds capacity beyond what the state claims it's able to do. So when you look at the sort of budgetary sort of nitty gritty of all of this, the Ford Foundation is substantially subsidizing in Boston and some of these groups what the government claims they are funding, right? Because the government isn't willing to fund overhead in the same kinds of ways. And so private philanthropic dollars are subsidizing state capacity in a way that is politically attractive to those who want to ensure degrees of austerity, particularly in the neighborhoods that we're talking about.
Well, and I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I couldn't stop thinking about as I was reading your book is there's an essay of Ruth Wilson Gilmore's called In the Shadow of the Shadow State, where she's talking about, you know, the kind of ways that nonprofits as a category, right, are sort of what is like the problem that they're seeking to solve, and like how do they become attractive to people across the aisle is part of it is like that ability to sort of propose the accountability and oversight, like the ability to yank the budget. And the efficiency comes from the idea that these budgets are small. These are lean organizations, sort of. They have, you know, you always see people talk about nonprofits as if they have some sort of like innate connection to the community intrinsically, mm-hmm. and therefore, like, it's important to sort of, like, for in the example of the COVID response, you know, like, community organizations were talked about as, like, a shortcut or a silver bullet. Like, okay, so we have this problem where, you know, we need to address vaccine inequity, for example. So, you know, rather than sort of doing the work, what we do is we, like, tap the nonprofits that we're going to partner with, and we go from there. And it's sort of like the idea being that, you know, these are capacities that either, you know, are beyond the scope of government, or they're sort of, you know, things that just, like, almost require too much work or something to be done efficiently at that scale. And there's sort of such a way also that this then shapes the very structure of the organizations, right? Because that very idea of accountability and the idea of running it lean, like, as you're saying, one of the kind of principal ideas that your book is engaging with is sort of, why do we attempt to solve such big problems with such small organizations, right? And I think, too, sort of, like, obviously the whole sort of relationship to power is very important, too, because as Ruth Wilson Gilmore writes, quote, "The shadow state is real, but without significant political clout, forbidden by law to advocate for systemic change and bound by public rules and nonprofit charters to stick to its mission or get out of business and suffer legal consequences if it strays along the way." You know, so much of the story here is not just sort of like what sort of structures prevent nonprofits from doing something beyond reproducing the status quo or sort of these small tweaks and sort of things like that, but it's also how are these organizations sort of shaped by the pressures of the state and by their relationship to the state.
Absolutely. This notion of nonprofits having to stay away from the political realm is both in reality and perception a huge quieting factor, right? And it's not so much that nonprofits are being challenged in the courts for engaging in, to be clear, they're prevented from partisan activity, right? Partisan and political, not the same thing, of course. And yet there's this sort of gray area where, and this ambiguity where nonprofits sort of often steer clear of getting a slap on the wrist. And it's the sort of in between, sort of informal kinds of discipline that, again, sort of try simultaneously build up alternative power structures, but then make sure that they never acquire too much power or too much independence. Because it is outside the traditional political realm. And so any kind of talk of policy, any kind of talk of sort of sustained political engagement is actively discouraged and undermined. It's the hardest thing to get funded and the thing for which organizations are cut off. And, you know, executive directors are put in this incredibly difficult position of both advancing a mission, which could and often would involve a policy argument, and needing to keep people employed, right? When you got to make payroll for people who are working hard, living and serving in a community, those issues of payroll are important. One example I'll pull on from the book is a group who was funded under the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, which started under Johnson but continued under Nixon most famously. And it was on a community security grant that funded this group in the South End that had started a neighborhood escort system. So on days when welfare checks were delivered to a local public housing development, a series of staff members would sort of patrol the community and help elderly folks go to the mailbox. And so this was a local grassroots program. And one of the organizers under it, this guy, William Shabazz, recognizes that what his neighbors in the public housing development need isn't just an escort to the mailbox, but they're deeply food insecure. And so he starts a surplus food program of dry beans, macaroni, powdered milk, of sort of redistributing some surplus food, right, to people in this community. And it's a really successful program, the sort of add-on. But city funders get word of this food program and give a big slap on the wrist to the grantee organization and say, this isn't what we funded you for. We funded you for security only, no can do. And the executive director tells Shabazz, look, great program, but I can't risk not getting funded again next year. And he gets fired. And the successful food distribution program, which in a different era, we would sort of applaud the responsiveness of this, the upstart grassroots self-initiative of this foodstuffs program, right, is threatening in some way to the city government, who either because they're worried about their federal funders or they don't like the notion of food distribution, maybe it smacks of socialist agenda, who knows what, right? They're not into the food program, they're just into the security program. And so he gets fired and the program ends. And it's that kind of both overt and covert disciplining of don't stray too far from the terms of your grant that keeps the political engagement, that of food program, right, which is a core program of the Black Panther Party, keeps that quiet and keeps it from continuing. And that kind of lack of political opportunity has been, by cuts both ways, of what enables these kinds of processes to be deeply popular with those in power and among elites, and prevents it from becoming anything more, which is what those on the ground have been pushing for a long time, right? That lack of political engagement. People were writing about and petitioning for, and right, their organizational records show they understand this inherent tension and are sort of grappling with how far can they push what their programs look like, how can they infuse a more political agenda, and the reality of their power is so deeply circumscribed by the structures of funding that accompany it.
Yeah, I love the way that you frame this as, you know, these, this can be both democratic and anti-democratic at the same time, and at sort of different scales and on different levels. And I think one of the really, really interesting stories that you tell throughout the book is the sort of shifting, I don't know, the shifting perspective and buy-in and function of Black organizers, you know, really over the course of the 1960s, kind of moving from the first half of that decade, sort of coming online in this new relationship to the federal state. And by the end of the decade, when it's Nixon in the White House and when Black power has become a much more significant political movement, the kind of shifting, not just ideology, but even the kind of, you know, notion. Well, I was just thinking of a particular example I'd love to have you share with us about the Roxbury Multi-Service Center, because it's so fascinating, this idea that went into the center, which opened in 1965, that you talk about this sort of a notion of a one-stop shop for social services, that you would just sort of put all these different referral services and counseling and employment services and kind of, you know, all of the sort of social service infrastructure you might need in one spot, and then people can come there for their problems and get referred out or get connected to services. You know, the Roxbury version of this was kind of a model that, you know, has an interesting career, because it seems like by the end of the 1960s, as the funding structure, the politics at the federal level are changing, and, you know, white backlash against Black freedom movements and Black rebellion has really, really, really grown. And in some ways, Nixon is riding that wave, but there are also local versions thereof. You also tell the story of the service center sort of at the same moment that it's kind of losing some of the funding it had enjoyed, sort of just deciding, well, we kind of function as the state in some of these neighborhoods, and there's a sort of Black nationalist way to do that. Anyways, I don't want to over-summarize. I was just sort of curious if you could maybe talk a little bit about that example as a portal to thinking about the way that that Black organizers and Black political movements get in on the ground floor of this new arrangement with the federal and local state, but also continue to transform and push as the politics kind of shift in the 1960s.
Yeah, thank you. One of the founders of the Roxbury Multi-Service Center is on the cover of the book. Hubie Jones is a younger man than he is today. Is really a really critical and interesting figure, and his career is fascinating. He is wonderful. Yes, the Roxbury Multi-Service Center, it founded, as you said, in the mid-1960s with both Ford Foundation dollars as part of their Gray Areas program and federal War on Poverty dollars. They don't own furniture, so they're sort of borrowing card tables. They're above a chicken shop or sort of a chicken farm, sort of place where you bought chickens, like live ones. And Yeah, they're trying to help their neighbors and start this one-stop shop where you could get these referrals, as you said, Jules. And Hubie Jones talks about coming from a social worker background where he's taught to sort of respond to the individual. And that was sort of the program model. And yet they realize, right, that people are coming in again and again and again looking for housing referrals, but the housing doesn't exist, or they're dealing with predatory landlords, or they're dealing with problems of insufficient wages or different family dynamics. And they see, right, and through their own neighbors telling them and their own lived experience, that this is a deeply structural problem. And so Roxbury Multi-Service begins to undergo this transformation as their own political and sort of situational experience shifts towards a Black nationalist tradition. They start observing a different set of holidays. They start supporting anti-Vietnam protests and sort of incubating in the ways that they can, lending some of their capacity to more overtly political entities as they sort of grapple with this role of being simultaneously fed by the state through these grants and dissatisfied about what their constraints politically and capacity-wise are. And so one of the pivots that they make, among others, is to sort of talk about, and again, a sort of nationalist self-deterministic lens, we don't want to just refer people to housing that doesn't exist. We want to build it. And this notion of building housing sort of aligns and owning the land thereof and investing in local business is this really interesting moment that plenty of people have written about in the Black nationalist tradition and the sort of rise of Black capitalism and the ways in which the market is seen as having emancipatory potential, right? That the freedom that one could get by owning the land and owning the housing and not at the whims of predatory, often white landlords, is a critical moment in the early 1970s. And I write also about a man, Mel King, who goes on to be a state representative and passed away just this past year, but long storied career. He's the first Black man to make it out of the primary for mayor in the early 1980s. But in the 1970s, he and others are thinking about what does it mean to turn to the market. And so on the one hand, I frame this as sort of shockingly aligned with the neoliberal sort of set of policies. They're looking for the state and for foundations to shift their grants to loans. So sort of think about a financialized model of lending instead of granting, helping community groups own housing that they are then going to rent out or sell. And so it's trying to lift and participate and bring these nonprofit organizations into a more capitalist fold. And so on the one hand, we can think about how that strategy sort of helps perpetuate neoliberal practices and policies that, you know, in retrospect, we know to be perpetuating of inequality. On the other hand, the historical record shows us that Hubie Jones and Mel King, when they're talking about the market and when they're talking about sort of the financial mechanisms that might shift for nonprofits, they're leveling a deep critique there of the state and of the grant-making programs in the 1960s because they realize how constraining they are and how the existing efforts within the nonprofit structure and within traditional government relationships have not created the kinds of power shifting that both had been promised or hoped for. And so that critique that they're leveling is a deep critique of the processes that they are participating in as nonprofit leaders, as staff members who are hiring people on these government programs. They see the inadequacy and they see a critique there about, as you were saying, the sort of simultaneous democratic and anti-democratic structures of building up this, quote, third space that is outside of policy and political processes.
But at the same time, there's a sort of lock-in effect, isn't there? I mean, the fact that they're now there's an organizational structure, there's some administrative in a way like down payment. Like, do you think the fact that the sort of relationships have proliferated in a way make it hard to bolt from that arrangement?
Oh, absolutely. Right. And sort of both administratively, but also at the day-to-day human level, right? You have staff, you're paying rent, you're, you know, collecting, you own housing that maybe people are living in. Absolutely. So it becomes this sort of lock-in, where as an executive director, you're scrambling for the next grant, right? You're always looking for what's the next federal program that I can sort of shift what I'm currently doing with enough continuity that it's not going to harm my staff or my constituents or my community, but I can tweak it just a little bit. So now we're doing education. Great. Mm. We can do a version of that. And there's a degree to which that is both authentic and performed, right? To sort of compete for grants, and you promise things and then only partially deliver, right? Which is true of any grant making relationship. But no, absolutely. It creates these systems that sort of self-perpetuate in a way that it becomes dangerous, right? To sort of level a critique about, you know, we're not able to do all of that, right? No organization, when you're seeking a grant, can claim a sense of inadequacy or can claim we're promising more than we can deliver. That would be a terribly risky move, and yet enables these kinds of storytelling about the triumphalism of the nonprofit sector, right? That those at the top, those in decision-making power, right? Whether that's local corporate elites who sort of like the do-good feel of sort of, you know, giving away scholarships of different sorts, right? That is both. How do you say no to at least some dollars coming your way, right? That's a politically risky move. And so one of the things that I try and think about is my critique of the sector in the book and in the work surrounding it. There's not a lot new there. And people who work in the sector know absolutely and have always known the inherent tensions and inadequacies. But because of where different people stand, have different ability to say that sort of the quiet part out loud, or to sort of name those political dynamics about how grants have perpetuated these systems and how we just keep on going, right? And it's why we talk about tweaking at the margins instead of actually having a bigger conversation overhauling why we rely on these organizations, right? They can't put themselves out of business. There's risk there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. No, I mean, this reminds me so much of the work of people like Dean Spade and Andrea Ritchie, who really talk about sort of how in so many ways, when movement work gets tied up in financing structures, you can often see sort of the structure of the financing itself acting as a way to pre-limit what the sort of long-term picture becomes, right? Like it's a way of sort of forcing the gaze away from the big picture and, you know, tying it up into what's the next grant cycle, what's the next project, what's the next campaign. And it's a kind of relentless, you know, and I think that kind of is obviously one, as you've been saying, and as your book really shows, one of the things that makes this so attractive, right, in our political economy is that scarcity and that ability to, I think, suck up time and space within an organization. I mean, you know, you talk about sort of the way that in such an important, I think, and nuanced way, the way that, you know, ultimately it's like, so often the conversation can be reduced to if nonprofits are bad, like then what, right? Or, you know, like what do you want, like a world where they weren't doing anything, right? Yeah. And no, absolutely no one is saying that at all. But it's so important to just stop and look at the structure of sort of how, as Ruth Wilson Gilmore says, the sort of shadow of the shadow state, actually what it looks like, right? Why the things aren't the way they are, because I think so many people sort of just take for granted the fact that these institutions, the nonprofit sector, you know, is the way it is because that is some sort of right way for it to be designed, right? Like that this is attractive and reproducible because it's good, right? And not that maybe it's attractive and reproducible because embedded in the financing structure are certain values that, you know, are very important in terms of reproducing austerity, in terms of sort of directing funds towards public funds, towards private goals, towards private wealth, towards building the state through a preference of public-private partnerships rather than building capacities of the state itself. And so, you know, it's not just about like individual organizations or administrations or types of governance. It's really also about kind of like an ethos of like how we want to build the state and how, you know, figures like who participate in this, regardless of sort of what perspective they're coming from and what their goals and their behavior and their decisions, you know, regardless of their values, are ultimately shaped and influenced by their interaction with the system and their relationship with the state.
Mm. Yes, to all of that. I guess to all of that. I'm sitting with what you said. So much of this can be a distraction, and yet let's just have a conversation about what a public good is and who should be delivering it, right? And who benefits. And these programs work in some ways, but they really don't work in other ways. And on the one hand, I'm empathetic to, right, bureaucrats and state authorities, right? If we're sending out public dollars, there does need to be a degree of accountability. And if tax dollars are going to public or private organizations, some kind of accounting for how those dollars are spent, right? There is the potential for bad actors, and there is the potential for things to go beyond what's intended. And on the other hand, the amount of burden that creates on organization, right, isn't an accident. Mm-hmm. There's a movement called trust-based philanthropy, which is certainly private giving, not public giving, so governed by a different set of practices and rules. But this notion of trust and surveillance and how much time gets eaten up in these processes rather than pausing and thinking about what's the actual goal here. And so often the actual goal is things that are perceived to be able to be measured and not things like ending white supremacy or reverting historical wrongs, right? Mm-hmm. The goals are both so much more modest because they can be counted and evaluated and measured.
But they're also programmatic goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Because those are things that can be measured. We don't talk about building power, A, because no one thinks you can measure that, but I'm sure people can. But we also assume the only thing, you totally can. But we also assume that it's only valuable if it can be measured, right? We shouldn't have to justify building power because it can be measured. That in and of itself could or perhaps should be a goal, right? And so all of this about where and how our priorities lie and who delivers them.
Well, you have a really great way of describing that in the conclusion, as there's been a preference for kind of engineering and changing systems, right? Systems of administration, systems of private public partnerships, systems of social service delivery, and so on and so forth. But those systems are actually supposed to be addressing structural problems, and structure and system don't necessarily even coincide, right? And so it just, in some ways, you know, here we are sitting on the outcome of a series of historical processes that your book tracks. And you also note, right, coming to Boston, I don't want to get too far ahead, but just coming to Boston in the contemporary moment, right, despite these decades of this nonprofit neighborhoods model, it's not like Boston, you know, is an affordable city with great infrastructure, you know, very little segregation, and affordable housing, right, and a plethora of well-accessed services. And in fact, the neighborhoods with the most of these nonprofit organizations remain, you know, still the neighborhoods with the least wealth, the least property ownership, the least, you know, by all of those quote unquote metrics, right? The ones that continue to be given the least resources and have, you know, have the worst outcomes, right? And so there is something sort of, I don't know, I just think like, again, because the way that the nonprofit complex just seems like it has somehow mythologized itself to make it seem like it's always been around and this is how we do it. And there's not much else we could do except tweak those systems. And yet in some ways it seems like this arrangement could never have actually fulfilled any of its promises because it was just sort of set up in some ways to miss the mark. I know there's no one person who designed this and there's no one entity that was responsible, but in some ways it feels a little bit like that fundamental mismatch between system and structure that is a sort of hallmark of the US state and of the liberal approach to all of this, right? Just sort of is one explanation for why, despite the grants handed out by the government increasing so dramatically, even from the 1950s to the 1960s, and the rise of this really well now professionalized, really smooth and slick nonprofit industrial complex, you know, it turns out we still don't have, we still haven't addressed poverty in cities in a meaningful way, and still don't have a functioning, you know, multiracial democracy, and so on and so forth. I mean,
no, I mean, I think there's certainly elements of that that are in the book, and I grapple with in my own right about sort of where do we go from here, and do we say that it was always doomed from the start? No, not necessarily. I think there were radical potential. It has been a profound change, right? So historians think about change and continuity and, mm-hmm. and the growth of the nonprofit sector and the movement of both authority and dollars through it has been a significant change over the past 60 years. And I would argue that we're not done yet. And the notion that we have to hold individual organizations accountable for things that are far beyond their own reach is a problem. And that it's not about doing away with the nonprofit sector or significantly shrinking the number of organizations or whatever, but it's about maybe rebalancing where burden and expectation to solve public problems are, and what is a public problem and who's responsible for it. I think we've offloaded way too much onto nonprofit organizations, such that the problems of racial inequality, of poverty in cities, as they were in the 1950s, were believed to be problems that could and should be solved by community organizations. Mm-hmm. And that's just not working for us. Those are problems that are created by the government, right? We could have a whole other series of episodes about how the government has created and perpetuated inequality and how its own operating procedures perpetuate these problems. And so therefore, the government bears a degree of responsibility that it has yet to take on, right? So one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is, right, how this book supports a broader conversation around reparations, right? Some of those broader conversations around what repair and public problem solving could look like, that can be nurtured by the nonprofit sector. They certain nonprofit organizations could and should continue to play a role in our society. But the burden of big problems and the notion that small entities through service provision can move the needle is not proven to be true by the historical right. record. And the sort right. of notion that systems mm-hmm. can change structures. We've moved systems a lot, right? We've fundamentally changed how money flows. We've fundamentally changed who delivers goods and services. Mm-hmm. That is really different. And it has made governance more participatory, more decentralized, and more diverse. And we don't want to necessarily let go of that. People fought long and hard for a seat at the table, and that should not be yanked away. At the same time, right, in the sort of both things can be true mantra, it's not touching the structural level. That is a policy and political move. And I think we are beginning to have that conversation, I think, publicly, right, that are the crises of the past, you know, few years, decades, whatever, we're more willing to talk about maybe government should or could play a larger role, right? I think right. we're on the cusp, or maybe we're in it, right, having those conversations. And so that's exciting to me.
But I think the question that keeps coming back to me as I read the book, right, is that it's the development that you talk about has really created a new field of power, right? It is mm-hmm. scrambled people's ability to act collectively, wouldn't you say? I mean, it's turned because these organizations, community foundations, are really where the resources are, right? Not necessarily in local governments. Mm-hmm. It's turned public attention to them as solutions, as opposed to government. That tends to scramble collective action. But it also it distances. I mean, the resources are in these communities, but other things aren't, like regulatory authority, for example, still remains, you know, firmly within the power of the local, or sometimes is preempted by the state government. But the but that's often the switch you need to flip. And the other thing that I think is interesting is like the extent to which, and maybe you can talk about this, like the kinds of solutions that now naturally enter into the conversation have changed. You know, the thing that you open the book with is talking about this social impact bond. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I wonder if you could actually go into it, because I think it matters that the solutions that are on the table, you know, to these problems have a way of, while they don't solve the problem, obviously, they perpetuate this idea that the solution is always just around the corner, and that like, give us five more years, give us 10 more years, give us $30 million more dollars, and give us an army of evaluators and social and like out of work social scientists to do the evaluation work, and we'll solve this goddamn problem. So can you like talk? I mean, like, there's a solutionism that is very rooted in some of these in these projects. But and so I wonder if you could talk about like that aspect of it as well.
The solutionism of it. Yeah, it seems both so rooted in optimism and a pragmatism about how to do something against what seems like inevitable odds. But no, yes. Social impact bonds are this wildly complex and yet also so simple. Sometimes called pay for success programs, right? So the government vows to pay a nonprofit for its services if the desired and sort of contractual outcome is achieved. And in the time between when the nonprofit provides a service and the government says, aha, we've done it, we've, you know, employed this many people, kept this many people out of the carceral state, et cetera, who puts up the dollars? Private financier. So Goldman Sachs is the sort of key financer, along with some foundations. They sort of put up a loan and say, okay, the government's going to pay us back, but we'll front the money to this nonprofit. It's these wild systems and tons of lawyers. And as you said, Phil, lots of social scientists evaluating and proving and all sorts of things before the money actually moves from the government to pay back Goldman Sachs, who initially fronted the money. And yeah, this notion that if we just sort of shift something small, something big will result, I think is enticing. That if we just change how the money flows, the structures underneath will alter. It's also a way to do something. I don't know. I'm not the one who can or should say what's like how we, like it's an imperfectly stacked deck. Right. The notion of austerity is always way overplayed than what it in reality could be. But people are dealing with constraints. Right. That's true of people in government, just as it's true of people in the nonprofit sector. And there's a series of tough choices about how you use limited resources, even though, right, we talk about them as if they're more limited than they truly are. Yeah, I don't have a great answer, but this sort of optimism and sense of the solutions just around the corner and that we can operate within more or less the confines, right? Mm-hmm. So much of this is based on the notion, right? The opportunity agenda of the 1960s looms large here, that largely our political economy is sound and that we just need to get people onto the ladder into it, right? Mm-hmm. That has been the underlying philosophy, gone by different names, gone by different sort of versions since then. I think nonprofits are wrapped up in the theory of the world that the political economy is basically sound. And we just need to get people into it rather than saying maybe it's a problem with our political economy and the racial capitalism that under sort of girds it. And nonprofits, by and large, right? And there's certainly exceptions to all of this who are willing to name those dynamics, but are largely operating under the, either because they believe it or they have to operate on under it to win funding. Things are basically sound and we just need to fine tune at the margins.
Right. I mean, there's that much bigger container, right, to look at all of this through that prism of the kind of decision coming out of World War II that the United States is going to, you know, as a tool of policymaking, you know, simply declare that, you know, the incredible boom in U.S. economic growth will just be the tide that lifts all ships, and there won't be any need to do sort of fundamental structural reform or major redistribution. Like, I can't remember off the top of my head the exact reference, but I was reading recently about an internal memo in the Johnson admin that was like, you know, just looking at some, you know, post-Marshall Plan European countries and even some, I think, Eastern Bloc countries, and was sort of like, okay, well, we calculate that if we wanted to completely eliminate poverty as defined by the federal state, you know, we could redistribute, you know, X amount of money. I think it was in the, you know, dozens of billions of dollars, just direct transfers to people. And we could, you know, within a couple, you know, within 10 years, functionally on paper, you know, eliminate that kind of wealth inequality version of poverty. And then in the next breath, reports like, but of course, we don't do that in America. We'll just have everyone, you know, we'll just improve everyone, right? Like, just to reemphasize for, you know, that these 1960s programs are all premised on the idea that the primary unit of inequality is the individual, which is just like wild. And so like getting that, I think that kind of solutionism or pragmatism in part is about, well, we got 20 people low paying jobs as typists in, you know, in the bureaucracy of this social service organization. Isn't that better than them being unemployed? And it's this like really intentionally decontextualized point of view that is, you know, operating at in a million different iterations around the country. And so, of course, it adds up to something, right? But that sort of very American sense of, well, we don't actually want to disturb the fundamental order of the political economy. We're just going to, you know, go full steam ahead on it ideologically and at the macro level, and then, you know, either hope that that lifts, you know, people up, or just make these little attunements. And where it fails, we can then fall back on really crass and usually racist massifying arguments that there's a culture of poverty in this neighborhood, and that's why it's not, you know, it's not rising with the tide of everyone else. But one thing I really wanted to ask you about too, I'm just sort of curious, is also about the nonprofit sector as a form of employment, because I feel like that's also a part of the story you're telling, and that kind of fits into this conversation we're having about the contradictions here, and also how people become stakeholders, right? Become stakeholders in systems that they don't even necessarily want to ratify. And one way is by getting employed. And I was just thinking about, and something I'm selfishly really interested in, the way that the rise of the nonprofit sector, you know, for example, creates a lot of employment opportunities, say for Black women. And, you know, it's at this moment of deindustrialization where, you know, the wage sector is going through a lot of flux and the loss of the kind of ideal of the unionized, you know, labor or the unionized steel job or whatever, right, is giving way to the healthcare sector worker. And, you know, there are just groups of people, you know, who have had incredible, incredible structural barriers to formal employment for so long are being now told in the 60s for the first time, like, hey, we could pay you for your experience of marginalization. We could pay you because you know your neighborhood so well, because you have been poor, because you've experienced police harassment or incarceration. That's a form of valuable knowledge, but we're going to pay you pretty bad wages, you know, relative to other sectors. And overall, the nonprofit sector, it seems like, is sort of part of this early kind of history of neoliberalism and the sort of move towards stagnating wages relative to cost of living overall in the economy. But it also seems to me, and I'm curious, yeah, what you would say about this too. It's like, you know, it's this, again, these kinds of situations where it's like, you're being offered a job, a formal job, a legit job, right? And like, that's really hard on the individual level to turn down. And why should people turn that down, right? But over time, we're also sort of seeing this kind of this precarity, you know, the role of women workers in general under war on poverty programs is really fascinating. The way that if you're on an unstable grant and your salary could be, you know, you could lose your job at any time, or you never quite get the right same benefits, or, you know, women were paid a lot less, or Black women were paid a lot less in certain sectors. I mean, I'm just sort of curious too, if part of the story here is about nonprofit jobs and social services jobs, not like they didn't exist prior to the mid-century, but that they undergo a kind of fundamental transformation that, you know, I think speaks to a wide variety of people's experience with the labor market to this day, where they're like, I have so many degrees and I'm paid so terribly. I wonder if some of that, you know, is traceable back to this moment.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked this employment question, because I do have I've written elsewhere about the sort of labor side of this. that it is absolutely, as you named, this moment of deindustrialization and sort of question of where people in cities are going to be employed. And there is a school of thought called the New Careers Program that comes out in the 1960s, where they sort of argue that the eds and meds and human services are the future of employment in cities. And growing these kinds of jobs, they're seen as entry level. They're called non-professional jobs, which is sort of a denigrating term, but in an attempt at the time to sort of recognize and create career ladders that are employing people who don't have the kinds of credentials that are typically valued. And as you said, have lived experience, right? They live in the public housing development where a local health center is starting, right? Or a Head Start organization that's a preschool and is hiring and employing and training parents, mothers of color in particular, and saying you deserve a wage and recognition and respect for the role that you're playing that likely had been a voluntary role up until then, right? And we can think about volunteering and highly gendered and racialized ways, and the ways about whose labor is or is not valued with a wage or who's able to donate time has a deep history. And so this is a moment of paying people and hiring. And I try and include a few pictures in the book of right when Freedom House begins to work for the Boston Redevelopment Authority around urban renewal, they hire 5 Black women who are now getting a wage, right? And some sort of benefits. That's profoundly transformational in the lives of individuals, in communities, for organizations, for sort of the professional field. But this theory of new career sort of assumed that if you got people on the career ladder, a ladder would be built, that there would be ways for promotion, that there would be salary increases, that these sort of non-professional jobs would lead to career ladders. And that didn't happen. Career ladders don't sort of appear out of nowhere. Grants notoriously keep wages purposefully low. Salaries are deeply depressed in the nonprofit sector. And so I write about elsewhere, a protest, right, where all of these, you know, people who are hired on these new career contracts in the 1960s say, I'm one step out of poverty, but I'm not far from it, right? Yeah. I'm working, but my wage is not sufficient, right? And that's a structural problem. That's not individual nonprofit organizations. And as I've alluded to, right, these executive directors are trying to keep people employed. They're losing payroll constantly, right? Mm. So people will go a month without being employed. The turnover is high. And at both an organizational and an individual employee level, that kind of disruption is deeply painful and sort of reinforces precarity at organizations and in the lives of people who are, you know, may love their job, may hate their job, may probably feel somewhere in between, but feel caught, right? That we don't pay people in the nonprofit sector well, that continues to be a significant problem. So either you have to have significant privilege, right, to be able to take jobs in this field or be willing to work for under what you're worth, or, right, you're battling constantly. Mm-hmm. And this kind of work is not supported in the same kinds of ways that work in other sectors are valued. And I think at both an individual level and the stories we tell, right? Underpaying workers in the nonprofit sector suggests and creates a narrative that it's optional, that it's supplement, and because your heart should be the one that compensates, or because you feel good about it, or you're helping people, right? Again, deeply gendered and racialized. And so the nonprofit sector is one of our most diverse workforces. But when you look at the more granular level, right, it continues to be at the top executive levels where pay is and can often be quite high. We're still seeing white men holding the majority of those roles. And so the dominance of women of color in the sector continue to be at the entry level position. Mm. And the sort of deep seated racism and sexism that pervades other sectors is very much present in the nonprofit sector as well. But we naturalize it because we say this is a helping field and people are relying on the goodness of their hearts to sort of do this kind of work. And who would step in if not for them? So I think that that's a huge, huge problem. And again, I want to circle back around the creation of this political economy of where everything is sound and we just need to lift people into it. One of the things that the nonprofits, the rise of the nonprofit sector has done that I trace in the book is it begins to recognize identities of sort of, it begins to recognize that the state has been built around the needs and expectations of the sort of the ideal citizen as a white, married, employed, straight person. Right. And so we begin to see through these kinds of government grants a recognition that people have other needs, right? The young and the old, people who don't speak English as their first language, right? Queer people, Black people, ethnic minorities, right? All the sort of diversity is beginning to get recognized through these grants, but their needs are seen as outside of the norm, right? That one of the things I want to think a lot about is we are simultaneously recognizing the needs of the sort of non-ideal citizen, but we're meeting them through privatized, unequal means. And I think the employment statistics, when we look at who's working in the nonprofit sector and who's being served, is a place where our values about whose problems are deserving of support and whose aren't are getting replicated.
One thing that you say in the book, and I think it's not merely because these nonprofits are providing jobs, it's also because they are, they're providing the connective tissue for land redevelopment deals, right? That they become in a way part of the growth machine, right? And I think that, you know, it's hard for me to understand that apart from the fact that there's, in a lot of the cities where this is happening, there remains massive disinvestment in a lot of neighborhoods, right? I was talking to somebody who is a public school advocate in St. Louis, and it had been kind of fighting this years long war with a charter voucher coalition. And, you know, she was saying, look, the people join this coalition not because they're sort of ideologically committed in any way to vouchers or charters, but because the coalition has resources, provides money, provides jobs, and there aren't any to go around. It also, you know, creates community institutions that in a place where they don't exist. And so I sort of wonder, you know, as we're thinking about this as like a history that helps us understand the kind of very fractured and unequal cities that, you know, I certainly live in, that many of us do live in, you know, what's the role of kind of local government and the federal government at actually coming in and, you know, doing things that to reinvest in ways that, you know, like channel power like more fruitfully or you know, allow for power to be built in places where it's so sort of decentralized and fragmented.
Yeah, I think a lot of people join these kinds of coalitions, which has always been true, right? Sort of holding your nose a little bit, right? Sort of you don't always have the privilege of ideological alignment. And so if it's an opportunity to bring some resources, if a charter school is the only way seemingly or real to get new school facilities or new curriculum or a degree of parental involvement that people are seeking, I think people have to often put their own ideologies or sort of politics aside in favor of desperate survival, right? Trying to win resources that maybe your kid or your family can take advantage of. That's a sort of constant, I think, of history. And we continue to see that played out. And the fact that those kinds of coalitions do have resources is a reflection of the preferences of elite donors. There's been some really interesting work on the Gates Foundation and others around how their interest in charter schools has created this sort of movement just because dollars have been on the table for that, whether or not that's been what people were asking for or not. So I think these kinds of, you chase money where it can exist, and these sort of both false binaries around like what's the alternative, but also sometimes there doesn't always appear a readily alternative in the lifespan of your own children going to school or your needing housing or your needing a job. So I think that the uneven landscape is real.
Yeah. I mean, I always think of it's such a difficult thing, right? That because those we, you know, like especially the work that I've done on disability, one of the critiques I get is like, Well, goddamn it, stop critiquing the ADA. You're gonna contribute to rolling it back. Or like, how dare you say Medicaid is imperfect? And like, absolutely,
yep.
You know, I completely empathize with that. But whenever I sort of encounter that, I always think back to this thing that Craig Wilsey says, who's, you know, longtime organizer, writer. And you talked about, you know, like, yeah, it's from Queer Dreams and Nonprofit Blues, which is like a series that I think is at the, we'll put a link to that maybe in the episode description because listeners would probably enjoy that as well. It's something Dean did many years ago in 2013. But he says, Craig says, we don't argue for some pure space where we can know that the political work we do is perfect and will have no unintended consequences and will have no harms. That's never going to happen. And I think sometimes we hold up a false model of that pure space and we measure our failures against that model. And I think we want to be experimental and thoughtful at the same time, right? So we want to think like, what does the nonprofit status help us do and what does it keep us from doing? And when we pair it with something that's not incorporated as a nonprofit, what can that work do? What can that autonomous grassroots organizing do? What are its limits? And how do we think about complements back and forth? So I think ultimately, I want the nonprofit forum to fall away along with the nation state forum. And so I think, you know, Craig's kind of take on it, and for a long time, he's done, you know, work where he's sort of working directly in the community with people who are homeless and then sort of writing about that. And he teaches. So he's someone who's like very critical of, you know, the kind of centrality of, you know, the kind of university expert and sort of needing to incorporate a critique of that into the work that you're doing. And I think that the way Craig talks about it is sort of like, you know, the comparison to a perfect political movement that exists in a vacuum, right? You know, it's kind of like fighting against that, like, oh, well, you use an iPhone and yet want communism kind of framework, right? Which is that, yes, like, we live under capitalism and the contradictions are the point, right? Like, the contradictions are what are intolerable. And these are things that are terrible. And these are, you know, sort of harms we shouldn't have to balance. And that's part of like where, you know, our political work and our political lives sort of comes from. It's not that like, you know, sort of looking at the ways that sort of our wins can have harms, right? Or, you know, even the maintenance of sort of the reproduction of our movements can have harms and the very structure that we have to sort of participate in or in the ways that the structures of our movements are shaped by the state and our relationships to the state, you know, is sweeping it under the rug helps nobody at the end of the day. And I think your book, you know, treats that with a lot of care and sort of, you know, kind of takes the perspective that I think Craig offers, which is like, you know, there is going to be no movement that has unintended consequences and harms. And so, well, how do we deal with that sort of contradiction and consequence other than being really honest about it and really trying to look at, you know, how does this sort of analysis help us understand decisions about the present and about our current movements? Because it's not just about litigating, you know, what worked 10 months ago or what worked 10 years ago or 100 years ago, but part of the very structure of sort of nonprofit as a model of privatization of public goods, right, keeps people accountable to those wins and successes, right? And sort of the failure itself is something that you want to shy away from if you're presenting yourself for, you know, oh, I deserve this grant, because so much of philanthropy ultimately is like investing in the idea that somebody has the knowledge to end poverty, not in like ending poverty itself, right?
I'm sitting with that quotation that you read and its power in naming both a place for ideal theory, and that we can't let that get in the way of the day-to-day realities of what we have in front of us and moving forward regardless of the inequities of our current system. I'm sitting with that quotation and really grateful to you for raising it up here. I think it captures beautifully and perfectly for me what the study of history can do for us, right? Which is to ground big visions and realities and to extend our muscles of empathy for people making tough decisions, which isn't to say not holding back the criticism for consequences that might have been intended or otherwise, often unintended, but to recognize people making decisions within a set of constraints and let's keep making decisions in the present, hopefully informed by that, but still with an eye towards a revolution that's incomplete. And the nonprofit sector can play a role in that, but maybe not as much as we've expected it to.
I think that is the perfect place to leave it for today, Claire. Thank you so much. This was such a fantastic conversation. And thank you again for this wonderful book.
Thank you for having me. And thank you for this conversation, truly.
And Claire's book, again, is Nonprofit Neighborhoods, an Urban History of Inequality in the American State, published by University of Chicago Press. And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire M. Dunning. Patrons, thank you so much for supporting the show. We couldn't do any of this without you. And if you'd like to help us out a little bit more, share the show with your friends, post about your favorite episodes, pick up a copy of Health Communism, or pre-order Jules' new book coming in January from Verso called A Short History of Trans Misogyny at your local bookstore, or request them at your local library, and follow us at deathpanel_. As always, Medicare for all now, solidarity forever. Stay alive another week.
Batman demanding like move I can't do. There wasn't a thing that you could do. I put my foot down. Done.